This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, an ugly export from the rich world. Indonesia cracks down on dumped plastic rubbish Western countries are shipping to it. Will Australia be a socially cohesive and financially strong nation or a divided country, vulnerable to economic headwinds? A major CSIRO report says we need to get our act together fast.
Our government, our large companies, the media, even NGOs have really lost the public's trust. The only way we're going to enact these major changes is if we take a long-term view. Unless our institutions can regain the public's trust, that's going to be incredibly difficult.
An Indigenous boy with an intellectual impairment was kept completely naked for days inside Brisbane's adult maximum security police watch house after being deemed a suicide risk. An officer from the Department of Child Safety raised serious high concerns for the boy and asked for help to get the police to provide him some clothes. Disability advocates have condemned the stripping of the boy as cruel and abusive, while the state opposition wants a royal commission. Mark Willisey has this exclusive report.
The case of this boy inside Brisbane's maximum security watch house would have remained secret, except for a right to information request which reveals a series of emails about his plight. One came from an officer from the Department of Child Safety on Monday the 15th of April this year, addressed to the Office of the Public Guardian.
He reported to me that he does not have any clothing, nor has had any since Thursday afternoon to put on, due to his suicide risk. He reported that he only has a blanket to wrap around himself and that he is completely naked.
The child safety officer said she had high concerns for the child and finished her email with a question for the Public Guardian.
Is there anyone that you know at the watch house that are with the Queensland Police Service that I would be able to address this concern with?
According to the correspondence obtained under right to information laws, the boy had expressed suicidal ideation. So officers decided to put him into a so-called suicide smock, a hospital gown-like garment designed to prevent self-harm.
Officers took him to a padded cell and requested that he put on a dress, which he stated he did not wish to wear. Subsequently, three or four male officers held him down and undressed him, and he was yelling and screaming the whole time.
Despite the officers' efforts, the boy refused to put on what he called a dress, so he was left naked with only a blanket to cover himself and put back in his holding cell with other child inmates. And he remained like this for about 4 days.
Oh, it's cruel. There's no other way to describe it. It's cruel. This is abuse.
Frances Kwon-Farrant is from People with Disability Australia. She's particularly concerned about this case because, as the documents reveal, the boy in question has fetal alcohol syndrome and an intellectual impairment.
I mean, that must have been absolutely terrifying. So he has an intellectual disability. He's experiencing suicidal ideation. He's terrified. This is going to have absolutely long-term repercussions. There's absolutely no doubt.
Last month, Four Corners revealed a series of worrying incidents involving kids inside Queensland's maximum security watchhouses, including a girl mistakenly put in with alleged male sex offenders and a child who had her finger severed in a cell door. This latest case has shocked the state's opposition leader, Deb Frecklington.
I actually just cannot believe it, that a child has been stripped naked and left naked for 4 days. I really don't care what this kid has done, but he should not be treated like that. We need a royal commission and we need it now.
AM asked the Queensland Police Service a series of questions about the stripping of this boy. It didn't respond, except to say that it holds the safety and well-being of people in its custody as a paramount priority.
Mark Willisey reporting there, and the Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk was unavailable for interview this morning as her office says she's travelling. And a spokeswoman for the state's Child Safety Minister, Di Farmer, says after being given the suicide smock, the boy was later assessed and found to be able to wear ordinary clothes. If you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Iran is warning that it will soon breach a major nuclear control agreement if European nations don't help it avoid crippling sanctions imposed by the United States. The US withdrawal from the nuclear deal last year has put enormous pressure on Iran and raised tensions in the region, which Europe says is dangerously close to war. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchik reports.
As the United States and its Middle Eastern allies try to increase pressure on Iran, the Iranian government is upping the stakes too. It's warning that without relief from crippling US sanctions, it will soon breach a key requirement of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the landmark nuclear control deal signed between Iran, the US, Germany, Britain, France, Russia, and China in 2015. The deal restricts Iran from stockpiling more than 300 kilograms of low-grade enriched uranium and from enriching it to higher levels. But a spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, Behrouz Kamalvandi, says Iran will soon break that commitment. We have quadrupled uranium production, he says. And in recent days, we've once again increased production. And today we can tell you that the countdown has started. In 10 days from now, on June the 27th, we will be past the limit of 300 kilograms. Iran's promise to scale back production and enrichment if European nations, which still support the nuclear control deal, help it circumvent the US sanctions. European governments say the situation is explosive. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, says there's a high risk of miscalculation.
What we would not like to see is a military escalation in the region. We think that would be extremely dangerous, definitely not positive, neither for anyone in the region, nor for Europe, neither for the rest of the world.
But the US National Security Council's called for more pressure on Iran, accusing the country of nuclear blackmail. Iran's nuclear warning comes just days after the US accused its military of attacking oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. The chief of staff of Iran's armed forces, Mohammad Bagheri, denies responsibility for the tanker attacks. If we decide to block the Strait of Hormuz, we'll do it in a way that even a drop of oil won't pass, he says. That's what world energy markets are afraid of, if no one backs away from the current confrontation. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Twarczyk reporting for AM.
Egypt's former President Mohamed Morsi has died after collapsing in a courtroom in Cairo. The Muslim Brotherhood figure was the country's first democratically elected leader before being ousted by the military in 2013. He'd been kept in solitary confinement ever since and was currently facing espionage charges. Connie Aegis reports.
A state television broadcast in Egypt was interrupted to make an announcement. The country's former president, Mohamed Morsi, had died.
Mohamed Morsi passed away today during an espionage court hearing. He asked the judge if he could speak and it was permitted. After the session was adjourned, he fainted and passed away. His body has been moved to the hospital.
Mohamed Morsi was the leader of the now-banned Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party and campaigned to become president in Egypt's first democratic election after dictator Hosni Mubarak was removed from power in 2011.
Our ideology is a clear Islamic ideology, a modern Egyptian state, nationalist, democratic, constitutional, in which the people are the source of authority.
He was elected, but the public turned against him for abuses of power in 2013. Mohamed Morsi was eventually ousted by the military, led by Egypt's current president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
President Morsi did not respond to the demands of the people.
The Muslim Brotherhood was banned and Mohamed Morsi was sent to prison, where he remained for the last 6 years. He's faced trial for allegedly leaking state secrets to Qatar, killing protesters during a sit-in outside the presidential palace, and spying for Hamas. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was one of the first to pay tribute to the former Egyptian president.
Mursi. İnandığı dava uğruna verdiği mücadele sırasında
we formed a close friendship with him before he was elected as president and preserved it afterwards. Morsi, who was put on trial by a court established by the coup, which sentenced him to death, gave his last breath in a courtroom. And this is a symbol of the cruelty inflicted upon him and his people for years. In our eyes, Mohamed Morsi is a martyr who lost his life while he fought for the cause he believed. History will never forget the tyrants who put him in prison.
No official cause of death has been given, but Mohamed Morsi's family has long complained that he'd been held in solitary confinement and denied medication.
Connie Agius reporting. The Foreign Minister Maurice Payne will travel to Papua New Guinea today in what will be the first Australian visit to the country since the election of its new Prime Minister. The visit comes as the government continues to reassert Australia's influence in the region amid growing Chinese interest. But at a time when Australia is trying to bolster its position, the issue of asylum seekers on Manus Island is casting a shadow over the visit and the broader relationship. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
Despite the long and close relationship between the two countries, one issue is casting a shadow: Manus Island.
It really is a stain on the bilateral relationship, and the bilateral relationship with PNG is much bigger than Manus Island.
Despite that, Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute says the Foreign Minister will likely find herself speaking about it again. In the latest issue, PNG's immigration minister has called for security company Paladin's contract to be terminated just after Australia's Home Affairs minister said it would likely be extended.
I think we will see more pressure from the PNG government to have a proper solution to Manus Island. But also, I think we're going to be seeing the PNG government wanting to talk to Australia about a number of other issues as well.
James Marape has only been PNG's Prime Minister for just over a fortnight, but he's already being pressed on the asylum seeker issue. The country's Catholic Bishops' Conference has written to him calling for action, and asylum seekers on Manus, like Benham Sata, are also speaking out.
We plead to him to find a solution for us and let out this Manus story finishes for good.
The governor of Manus, Charlie Benjamin, has said he wants Australia to immediately remove the remaining men. Mr. Benjamin says the experience with the asylum seekers has also left him questioning Australia's plan to partner with PNG and the US to redevelop the Lombrum Naval Base on Manus.
With all of this, I am very reluctant to have Australia involved on Manus Island and the Americans to come here.
The naval base redevelopment has been interpreted as Australia and the US sending a strong message to China. Initial work has already begun, but Mr. Benjamin says there are still questions to be answered.
The important thing is that consultation, that is what has been missing in the past. It's a big program, it's a big project, and we expect the PNG government and the Australian government, or be it American government, to ensure that Manus is being taken care of.
Maurice Payne will be in Papua New Guinea for 3 days. Jonathan Pryke says the rise of China and the subsequent renewed interest from Australia leaves PNG in a powerful position.
China provides an alternative to what Australia offers and what other traditional partners offer. And so that gives a lot more power to PNG, to PNG politicians, to Mr. Marape, to leverage these relationships to their benefit. And that's just smart diplomacy.
Given the current focus on the region, PNG's new government can expect many more opportunities to flex those diplomatic muscles. This is Natalie Whiting in Port Moresby for AM.
And thanks for your company this morning on AM, where it's 13 past 8. Indonesia is the latest country to crack down on the illegal import of plastic waste from countries including Australia. Jakarta says it won't hesitate to send back shipping containers found with household plastic rubbish, which is banned in Indonesia. Authorities in Eastern Java are today planning to return 11 containers contaminated with plastic from Canada. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
At a factory in Eastern Java, a man stokes an oven. It looks like a rubbish dump. Everywhere around him is rubbish. But workers here are making tofu, one of Indonesia's most popular dishes. It's hot, dirty and dangerous work because of the fuel they use in the ovens. If we only use wood, it's more expensive, says the factory owner, Nanang. Plastic is cheaper and burns at a higher temperature for longer. And it's not local plastic they're burning. What's fueling these ovens is household plastic waste from Western countries, including Australia, and shipped illegally to Indonesia. Familiar brands seen in most Australian supermarkets are buried among the mountains of waste that blanket villages like these. We have documents showing it's come from Melbourne, Brisbane or Sydney, says environmentalist Prigi Arasandi. He spent months documenting the illegal plastic
waste problem in eastern Java. The import documents say they're exporting paper, he says, but about 30% of it is actually plastics. It's illegal. It's a violation of the law. Indonesia has become a dumping ground for the Western world's rubbish since China last year banned imports of foreign waste. Increasingly, authorities in Java are finding plastic smuggled in containers of paper waste that are exported lawfully to local paper mills. The mills can't use the plastic and sell it to the tofu factories and villagers grateful for any income they can make from it. But they pay a heavy personal price. The plastic produces toxic smoke that causes respiratory problems and contaminates the local waterways. But now Indonesia, like China, has had enough. The government in Jakarta has declared it won't hesitate to send back each and every illegal load of plastic found on Indonesia's wharves. If we find waste that doesn't match the import documents, we'll send it straight back to the country of origin, says Syed Muhadhar from the Department of Solid Waste and Hazardous Substances Management. Indeed, this past week, authorities in Surabaya have re-exported 5 containers of plastic waste to the US. And environmentalists recently marched to the Australian Embassy in Jakarta, carrying a collection of rubbish and a strongly worded letter demanding Australia recycle its own waste at home instead of using Indonesia as a dumpster. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta for AM.
There's more evidence today of just how deep the drought is gripping the country, and you can see it at a port in New South Wales. For the first time in a decade, Australia, one of the biggest grain producers in the world, is importing grain. A shipload of Canadian wheat is being unloaded at a port near Nowra, ready to be processed at the Manildra flour mills. Kath Sullivan prepared this report.
It's a bit of pill to swallow to have to say that we're now importing grain.
Grain Producers Chair Andrew Wiedemann doesn't like the idea of grain imports, but admits a poor harvest has put pressure on the businesses that rely on the crop.
We've seen very little production right down the east coast, and the demand for specific quality type grains increasing, and the risk to the businesses themselves of actually staying in business. So we've got a catch-22 situation, there's no doubt.
The importer is Australian-owned Manildra Group, which processes the grain to make starch and gluten for food and industrial products. It declined to speak to the ABC, but in an open letter to farmers, it warned it would need to continue to import grain to its Nowra factory until the end of 2019.
It is the first time in Manildra Group's 67-year history that exceptional drought circumstances have forced the requirement to import.
So far, Manildra has been granted permission to import 3 shipments of wheat, and the Agriculture Department is assessing a further 9 applications to import a variety of grains. While the imports are on the rise, the government's chief commodity forecaster, ABARES, says our national crop is growing.
The winter crop prospects at this point in the season look better this year than they looked last year.
Chief forecaster Peter Gooday.
So we're expecting that the winter crop production will be up by about 20% compared to last year. That's still 10% below the longer term average.
Peter Gooday says the value of Australia's farm produce across the board will continue to fall next year, even if the rainfall returns to normal levels.
Compared to this time last year, seasonal conditions are looking pretty good, but we're not expecting that to translate into an immediate increase in export values.
Peter Gooday expects Australian farmers will grow $59 billion worth of produce in 2019-20. That's about 3% down on this year. Part of the reason it won't increase, even if the seasons do go to plan, is because so many farmers decided to sell their livestock prematurely rather than fork out huge amounts to buy and feed. Drought forced cattle grazier Tony Hegarty to make the difficult call to destock on his New South Wales farm last year.
It's very difficult to lock yourself into something where you see no end. No end to the feeding, no end to the costs. And the destocking at the moment has been a very good option.
But now, thanks to recent rains, he is rebuilding.
It's not as if it's a catastrophic shock. It's a bit slower, and I think the market's good enough and the outlook for the market is good enough to have confidence to rebuild.
That's cattle producer Tony Hegarty, ending that report by Kath Sullivan. The Australian Signals Directorate has been in the media spotlight for some time now, with the federal government looking at whether the agency should have more of a role in fighting cybercrime across the country. No decisions have been made yet. The Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, says he wants to discuss the issue further, and those within the cybersecurity sector say transparency is the key. Here's political reporter Stephanie Boris.
The Australian Signals Directorate is the country's cyber spy agency. It supports military operations overseas and goes after offshore cyber criminals. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton has again questioned whether it has a role to play here on home soil.
I think there needs to be a sensible discussion about whether or not we've got the ability to deal with threats that we face.
The minister has asked whether the ASD should be able to step in and help if, for example, there was a cyber attack on an Australian bank. Dr. Leslie Seebeck is the CEO of the Cyber Institute at the Australian National University.
We can't rely just on one agency, which is in the defence portfolio, which comes from quite a focused national security area.
She agrees a conversation about how to protect Australians against cyber attacks is needed, as our critical infrastructure networks, such as electricity and gas, are vulnerable.
None of this has been built in the past for security. It's been built for things like reliability.
But Dr. Seebeck says it's up to industry to do the heavy lifting.
The trick is to build a sector that has the, you know, sort of the robustness to be able not only withstand an attack as a sector, but to be then be able to sort of go in and change and adapt and adopt.
Tom Uren is a senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Cyber Centre.
ASD already has the mandate to provide technical assistance to other agencies in the Intelligence Services Act. So it'd be really useful to have some particular clarity on exactly where they think they can help.
Peter Dutton has also questioned whether the ASD has a role to play in fighting crime here in Australia, such as shutting down online pedophile networks. Tom Uren says Australia already has strong law enforcement bodies and wants the government to explain exactly why ASD's role needs to be expanded.
We've traditionally had a separation of internal security and foreign intelligence because they do different roles and they have different impacts upon the community.
Discussions about whether to expand the role of the ASD are now more than a year old. Those in the cybersecurity sector say it's time for a more transparent conversation about what could change. The ABC understands that if the ASD is approved to take on a domestic role, it could be tasked with shutting down computer systems being used by criminals and conduct covert operations on Australian companies to check how vulnerable they are to attacks. Labor has said it will consider any options put before Parliament, but has asked for a full explanation about any proposal and what safeguards will be in place.
Stephanie Boris reporting. This could be a big ask at this time of morning, but what do you think Australia could look like in 2060? CSIRO has put some thought into that. In fact, 2 years' worth of work, and it's come up with two very different scenarios. One has Australia drifting into the future, divided and vulnerable to global economic shocks. The other offers a much brighter future, where the nation is socially cohesive and economically strong. But that last outlook depends on Australia increasing its uptake of technology, being more energy efficient and living in higher density cities. Lexi Metherill reports.
Congested cities, low wages, unaffordable homes and a divided society. Sound familiar? Well, the CSIRO says it's going to get worse by 2060 unless there's change. James Deverell is the director of CSIRO Futures.
If we sit on our hands, if we don't take strong action, we risk ending up in this slow decline scenario, and that really doesn't look good for the future of Australia.
But if there's increased adoption of technology and we do more with less energy, he says the future could be bright.
You know, we could get to a point where in 2060 we'd only be using 6% more energy than we do today, and that's despite having 60% more people and an economy that's three times bigger than it is today.
CSIRO's modelling suggests economic growth would sit at 2.8% compared to 2.1% in the do-nothing scenario. If we sit on our hands, wages would be 40% higher. That doesn't sound so bad, but the CSIRO says they could be almost double what they are today if we take action. And James Deverell says if there's global cooperation on climate change, Australia would no longer be generating emissions but actually removing carbon from the atmosphere.
We'd also see a wider diversity of housing and land use across the city. And what this would do is let more people live close to where they work, where they play, where they go to school. Ultimately, that would lead us to having roughly a 45% decline in per capita car usage by 2060.
Predicting all the way out to 2060 is risky, but futurist Mark Pesci says there are things we can be sure of.
We can plan for the fact that there will be a lot of technology and there will be a lot of tools that will help make us smarter if we are smart enough to use that. That we can absolutely guarantee. So the thing is to build on the things that we absolutely know are going to happen, use those as a foundation and make ourselves wise enough that whatever the world throws at us, we're able to cope with.
He says constantly upgrading workers' skills will be crucial.
We're really good at educating people up to when they leave university. We're going to have to sort of break that line and just integrate it into part of our work practice. If we do that, then we will be able to keep pace as the rest of the world gets faster and smarter, and we will not lose our place in that world.
James Deverell says Australians will have to be open to engaging with new ideas and to tackling challenges.
Our major institutions, so our government, our large companies, the media, even NGOs, have really lost the public's trust. And the only way we're going to enact these major changes and get to the more successful outcomes described in the report is if we take a long-term view. Unless our institutions can regain the public's trust, that's going to be incredibly difficult.
That's the director of CSIRO Futures, James Deverell, ending Lexi Metherell's report. The arrival of Indigenous Australians more than 50,000 years ago is one of the most fascinating migration stories in history, but until now there's been little investigation of the route they travelled to get here. Now a group of scientists has produced new research on the extraordinary island-hopping journeys they undertook. These latest findings support the theory that their migrations were carefully planned, involving sophisticated maritime capabilities. David Sparks reports.
Researchers have provided the most detailed account yet of the seaborne migration of humans to this continent 50,000 years ago. Professor Corey Bradshaw from Flinders University says it tells us something special about the first Australians.
It certainly sheds a lot of light on just the sophistication of the society. You know, this is mind-boggling time periods in the past. We're talking tens of millennia before the ancient Egyptians were even a thought. You know, this is really seriously old stuff. And yet they clearly had the technological capacity, the intellectual capacity, the organizational capacity to be able to do these long and difficult journeys across open water. And in many cases, not knowing necessarily what was on the other side.
When the migration took place, Australia was connected to modern-day Papua New Guinea and Western Papua in one landmass, a mega-continent known as Sahul. But the stretch from Western Papua across to mainland Asia was still a long and dangerous archipelago.
There are two sort of accepted main routes. There are likely others, but the first one was basically through the northern part of the Indonesian archipelago that went through and up to the northwestern corner of West Papua, what we call Bird's Head now. That was the most likely route simply because it had the shortest distance between the small islands that you could island hop through. The southern route, which is probably the next strongest candidate, at least in terms of ease of passage, it probably went from Flores through to Aloha and then down through Timor, perhaps Roti, and then onto the small islands of the Sahul Shelf, which, as I said, are now drowned.
And that would have brought them to modern-day Australia, somewhere around the Kimberley, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. Well, the Kimberley would have been quite far from that particular position, but they would eventually got there.
Rather than a series of accidental steps, Professor Bradshaw says the migration would have been clever and very deliberate.
Suffice it to say, whether they were under sail, under wind, or they were paddling, or both, they were certainly going in a particular direction that they wanted to go in, and they were using some form of propulsion. That we do know.
You and the other scientists have come to the view that this was quite a deliberate migration. What do you mean by deliberate?
Well, the main thing was that a couple of people arriving on an island and then hoping to establish a large population is pretty unlikely for various reasons. For example, just inbreeding depression. I mean, not having a sufficient number of settlers. So you had to plan fairly large voyages with quite a few people and probably a lot of resources, tools, extra food, probably extra clothing, all sorts of things that you'd need once you got to the new land. That's a major organization to do something like that.
The research was completed by scientists from several universities for the Centre of Excellence for Australian Biodiversity and Heritage.
David Sparks reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news and current affairs podcast, The Signal. On today's episode, we retrace the day Aboriginal woman Tanya Day was arrested on a train in regional Victoria for public drunkenness and wound up with fatal head injuries in hospital.
Had she not been Aboriginal, you know, would this have happened? It's probably not likely.
That's not always easy for people to confront, that they might discriminate, knowingly or otherwise. But it is possible to change.
Today we meet someone who works directly with police to try to fix that problem in the US, and the people who want police in Australia to try the same thing. That's The Signal. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you usually get your podcasts.